We talk a lot on this program, and rightly so, about where Barack Obama is taking this country. Now, we talked a lot about it before he was ever elected, and we tried to tell you that Barack Obama, for all intents and purposes, is a Marxist socialist. And he has certainly governed that way. And prior to his becoming the president of the United States, he was doing one of these, I don't know if it was an interview or a debate, and he was asked a direct question about what he thought about the Constitution of the United States. And you remember that he said that it was, I don't know that he said the Constitution itself was deeply flawed or if those who wrote it were deeply flawed. Well, we've got the audio here. Let's hear what then-candidate Obama had to say. I think he was a candidate. He may have already been president. I don't know. This is what Barack Obama said about the Constitution of the United States being deeply flawed.
Barack Obama, what are your thoughts on the Declaration of Constitution?
You know, I think it's a remarkable document. I think the original Constitution, as well as the Civil War amendments, but I think it is an imperfect document, and I think it is a document that reflects some deep flaws in American culture, the colonial culture nascent at that time. African Americans were not, first of all, they weren't African Americans. So the Africans at the time were not considered as part of the polity that was of concern to the framers. I think that, as Richard said, it was a nagging problem in the same way that these days we might think of environmental issues or some other problem that where you have to balance, you know, cost benefits, as opposed to seeing it as a moral problem involving persons of moral worth. And in that sense, I think we can say that the Constitution reflected a enormous blind spot in this culture that carries on until this day, and that the framers had that same blind spot. I don't think the two views are contradictory to say that it was a remarkable political document that paved the way for where we are now, and to say that it also reflected the fundamental flaw of this country that continues to this day.
That was Barack Obama in 2008. This is Barack Obama in August of this year, just a few months ago, talking to a fundraising group, many of his supporters. I'm not sure exactly where, but this is what Barack Obama characterized our democracy.
And when I said change we can believe in, I didn't say change we can believe in tomorrow. Not change we can believe in next week. We knew this was going to take time because we've got this big, messy, tough democracy. And that's a great thing about America is that there are all these contentious ideas that are out there. And we've got to make our case. And we knew that these challenges weren't made overnight and they weren't going to be solved overnight.
We've got this big, what did he say, this big, messy, tough democracy. And then it's as if he caught himself and said, wow, I just threw democracy under the bus. I think I better make it clear that I don't believe democracy is such a bad thing after all. And he quickly recovers from that. This is a president who's wasted no time in the nearly 3 years he's been president of skirting every possible democratic process to get his agenda through. And it's all detailed in a brand new book, Democracy Denied, How Obama is Ignoring You and Bypassing Congress to Radically Transform America, and How to Stop Him. It's written by Phil Kirpin. Phil is Vice President for Policy at Americans for Prosperity, and the website for the book is very simply democracydenied.com. Phil, it's an honor to welcome you here to the Paul Edwards Program.
Oh, my pleasure, Paul, and thanks for having me on the show.
What do you make of this president? I mean, am I being fair by playing that clip of what he said about his view of the Constitution as deeply flawed, written in an era where people were deeply flawed, a culture that was deeply flawed? Am I taking that out of context? Am I being unfair? Or does this really inform this president's view of the democratic process?
I think you're being very fair. I think you're being very fair. And frankly, there are many quotes out there from the president that make him appear in a more negative light, should you wish to go that way. I mean, there was one from back when he was a state senator where he said that the Warren Court failed to break free from the constraints placed on us by our founders and failed to pursue redistributive justice. Well, I mean, So to say that he feels that constitutional constraints are still this nagging problem, or that they present this nagging problem in the way that he did in the clip you showed, I think it's pretty basic to the way that he's approached being president of the United States. I mean, he's got his objectives that he wants to accomplish. Most of them relate to the so-called social justice agenda, the redistribution of wealth, the privileging of certain groups, to give them resources they haven't necessarily earned, and so on. And he sees the Constitution, our formal structure of government, as an impediment to accomplish that. And so he sets out to see how he can work around that impediment to accomplish his objectives. And, he's got a very strange relationship with democracy, as you could tell from that second clip you played and, the sort of observation that he seems to think that actually convincing the American people, convincing voters, is a big obstacle to accomplishing the sort of redistributive or social justice objectives that he's got. And, this Wednesday will be exactly 1 year from the 2010 election, one of the biggest electoral landslides we've ever seen in the history of this country. And I believed at the time that we had seen an utter repudiation of this president's agenda, and that therefore that agenda would stop to move forward. I thought that with a Republican House, we would no longer see the country moving far left. And that hasn't been the case at all, because this president has contrived to get around that Congress. In fact, he spent the last 2 weeks bragging about how he won't wait for Congress. He's going to move forward on all of these different fronts with more bailouts and stimulus, et cetera. And so I think it's a very serious situation that we're in right now, and I think your portrayal of his intentions is more than fair.
He says, Phil, he's got this new agenda. We can't wait, in quotes. And he's making that and politically, it may play well in Peoria, but it's disastrous, isn't it, for this president to be using executive orders to do an end run around Congress? And it should be pointed out that it's the Democrat-controlled Senate that has stalled on much of this president's agenda, on some of the more radical parts of his agenda. But this notion of using executive orders, he did it again earlier today with the FDA. How dangerous is that for a president? And is it typical of a president, or are we seeing Barack Obama use the executive order as a way to get around Congress and the American people in an unprecedented kind of way?
Well, the interesting thing on that, Paul, is Obama campaigned against President Bush's use of executive power. This was actually one of the major themes in the 2008 election. I remember Obama said something to the effect of, I taught constitutional law for 10 years. I know the president can't just make up the laws as he goes along. And he said, he was outraged at Bush's use of signing statements and the wiretaps and a lot of things in the national security realm. And then Obama came in, continued every single one of those Bush policies, including the aggressive use of signing statements, by the way, which the left told us was dictatorial when Bush did it. And now we're seeing Obama push forward with every aspect of domestic policy through the agencies and the czars and the executive orders and so on without respect to Congress. And so the energy agenda is shifted to the EPA and the union agenda to the National Labor Relations Board, et cetera. And now we're seeing executive orders to push FDA policy changes as well as of today. It's not that no president has done this before. Presidents have tried, and certainly, as I said, Bush was criticized by the left for this, but I don't think we've ever seen it taken to this level of just complete disregard for what the American people said in the last election and for our institutions, in particular Congress. Not only does the Constitution say Congress writes the laws, but it's utterly unambiguous that Congress has the power of the purse and the president cannot spend money that isn't authorized by Congress. And yet last week we had a mortgage bailout and a student loan bailout, both of which cost millions and millions of taxpayer dollars, and the president alleges he can do them without Congress. Now, Speaker Boehner said that he thinks this is almost laughable. He's got, I think, a better sense of humor than I do, because I don't think it's funny at all what this president's doing.
Phil Kirpin, my guest, the author of Democracy Denied. He's vice president for policy at Americans for Prosperity. The website for the book, democracydenied.org. I think I may have said .com earlier. It's democracydenied.org. This is a president who is using government bureaucrats to forward his agenda and doing an end run around elected representatives. How dangerous is that to our democracy?
Well, I mean, it's very frightening, because if it essentially means that the congressional elections don't matter, and that seems to be what he's saying when he says the whole agenda the American people rejected last year can move forward anyway, then you get something like a four-year elected king who can do whatever he wants. And yes, you do have an opportunity to have a vote on the president, but I don't think that that is a sufficient democratic check on the use of power. And, you know, I think that people who are supporting this president using his agencies to get around the Constitution and get around the election need to be very, very careful of what they wish for, because they are very likely to sometime in their lifetimes have a president that they do not agree with and wish that we still had a functioning separation of powers and checks and balances. And so I really think that no matter what happens in the presidential election, it's really crucial that as citizens and voters, we demand that Congress as an institution stand up for itself and defend its prerogatives and take the responsibility of being the legislative branch very seriously and pass some laws that restrict these abuses of bureaucratic and regulatory power, shift things back where they belong into the congressional realm.
One of the areas where we're seeing what might be abuse and certainly some regulatory reach is with the FCC and the Internet. You know, the Internet's been around 15, 20 years now, maybe a little longer than that, but the reality is we all log on to it and we use it. It's become a part of our everyday lives. It's as a part of our lives as Alexander Graham Bell's new invention was when it first it took on popular use. What is the president's agenda when it comes to restricting or regulating the Internet through the FCC?
Well, I think this is one of the most important topics that I discuss in the book, and it's the entirety of Chapter 3. The Internet has been completely unregulated since 2002. In 2002, the FCC did something very smart. They said broadband Internet access is not going to be regulated. We're going to let the phone guys and the cable guys compete, and we'll see where this all shakes out. They correctly reasoned the technology was changing far too rapidly for regulators and bureaucrats to try to keep up with it and try to write rules for it. And it's been one of the most successful policies we've ever had in this country. With no regulation, broadband Internet access has improved leaps and bounds, and the past decade has been an unbelievable success story. It also, by the way, on the employment side, unemployment in the tech sector is somewhere between 3 and 3.5%. I haven't looked up the latest numbers, but it's been in the 3 to 3.5% range. Rest of the economy is somewhere around 10%. I would suggest it's because we haven't regulated the Internet that it's been so successful. It hasn't had to deal with all the bureaucracy and the red tape and all the other problems that have crippled a lot of other sectors. The Democrats, however, have viewed the deregulation of the Internet in 2002 as a mistake almost from the beginning. They've consistently said we've got to have the FCC managing these networks, telling phone and cable companies what they can and can't do, how they can manage traffic, what technology they can use, and so on. 95 Democrats campaigned on this idea 1 year ago. All 95 lost. It was a perfect record of failure as a political issue. It went 0 for 95. Nonetheless, Obama's good friend Julius Genachowski, who's his chairman at the FCC, one of his law school friends and one of his top fundraisers, pushed this through on a 3-2 party line vote. They are going to begin regulating broadband Internet as of November 20th. So less than a month from now, we're going to start the first regulations of broadband Internet in a decade. They claim the FCC will only use this power to prevent terrible abuses by the phone and cable companies. I believe it will have a very negative effect, because having regulators empowered to decide what can and can't move forward in terms of network practices will greatly deter investment. I think it'll cost hundreds of thousands of jobs. There was a new study that just came out recently that said these regulations could prevent as many as 500,000 jobs from being created by diminishing investment in the Internet. It's going to undermine one of the best sectors of the economy we've got right now. And I don't know why, because there's no problem here that needs to be solved. So it's a very unfortunate situation. The House has already voted to overturn these rules, and we're expecting a Senate vote sometime soon. And I think it's going to be a very telling vote for senators who claim they want to create jobs and have economic growth in this country. We'll see if they put this sort of left-wing ideology of bureaucrats and regulators need to control everything ahead of economic common sense and continuing a policy that's worked really well of not regulating the Internet. So we're going to be watching that Senate vote very closely, and I think it's important that the Senate vote to overturn these rules so they never go into effect.
Relative to the Internet, is there an agenda? Did anything in your research, Phil, point to an agenda on the part of this administration to control communication. That is, what kind of news the American people are going to receive. Glenn Beck mentioned something about this last week. The emergency alert system went down for the first time. It was tested nationally because the White House allegedly wants to be able to control the timing of any information in an emergency, determine when what is an emergency. His and I got to be honest with you, Phil. I always take Glenn Beck with a bit of a grain of salt. I'm not an enemy of Glenn Beck, but neither am I an avid follower. But when he talks about the emergency alert system being used in a way by this administration to control the content of events being communicated, news being communicated to the American people, is there any sense in any of the research that you've done that would give you the sense that this president is about controlling the content or even the channel through which the American people receive their news and what that news is?
Well, first of all, I love Glenn. He endorsed the book, and he's having me on the show tomorrow, so I'm not going to say anything negative about him.
Good.
But, look, I think that if you sort of connect the dots, there's a lot that suggests that this administration wants to have tight control over information. And it's not just that they're setting us down the path of government regulation of the Internet, although I think that's a large element of it. But they've also got a lot of ties between the administration and some pretty radical left-wing groups, the so-called media reform movement, groups like Free Press, which was founded by an avowed socialist, Robert McChesney, who says he wants to divest all the media companies from control. And they've got this mentality that, they know what's best for us. And, it's the same mentality we see in a lot of these regulations, but this idea that, they need to force people to consume the good stuff culturally, by which they mean, PBS and NPR, et cetera. They don't like how things have opened up now with all the conservative talk radio that's out there, with all the things that are on the Internet, with all the cable channels on TV. I think there's this sort of cultural elitist strain that runs through this administration and some of the outside groups that they have ties to, and they do seem to want to exercise control over information, which is why I'm very concerned that economic regulation of the Internet will lead to content regulation. And on the broadcast side, I believe they're using localism and diversity as ways to accomplish the same goals as the old fairness doctrine that they got rid of. So that impulse is real. Now, this test of the national emergency broadcast system is interesting because the emergency broadcast system has always been local. It's always been very local, and they break in with alerts. And the idea behind it is you break in with these alerts when something's going on so that if people are watching national programming or out-of-market programming, they'll get that breaking local news. They won't have to switch to a local channel to get that. Now, in a genuine national emergency, it seems to me that people will get coverage of what's going on almost no matter what they're watching. It's the nature of a national emergency. They tend to have breaking in coverage on all the channels. And so I don't know what sort of a scenario would require the national use of the emergency broadcast system. Nonetheless, they are testing it. And perhaps unsurprisingly, they're testing it at 2 p.m. to preempt the Limbaugh show, a lot of other popular afternoon shows. Maybe that's conspiracy theory stuff, but it is an interesting choice of times, to say the least.
What is the RAINS Act?
This is legislation that I'm really, really excited about. This is a bill, and I've got the whole story of it in Chapter 1 of the book. It came from an amazing guy, 78-year-old former county judge in Campbell County, Kentucky, named Lloyd Rogers, who grew up in an orphanage, served in the Navy for 4 years. Then he worked for Cincinnati Bell for 30 years, and then he went into politics late in life. So amazing life story behind it. But he handed his congressman a piece of paper that said, Article 1, Section 1, United States Constitution, all legislative power herein granted is vested in the Congress of the United States. And he said the EPA had just imposed a $1 billion, stormwater consent decree on the sewer district there in northern Kentucky. And he said, why don't you guys vote on this stuff? You're supposed to be the legislative branch. How can EPA double my water bill without you voting on it, without legislators being in the loop? And his congressman, Jeff Davis, got it right away, introduced it as legislation called the RAINS Act, H.R. 10, Regulations from the Executive in Need of Scrutiny Act. It now has 192 co-sponsors, probably more than just about any other bill up there, and we think it's going to pass the House this year. It's a very simple bill. It says any regulation that has a significant economic impact cannot take effect unless Congress votes to approve it and the president signs it, or if the president vetoes it, Congress overrides that veto. It says anything that's going to affect the economy has got to go through the legitimate constitutional process for writing laws, not the backdoor process of bureaucrats and regulators. So I'm really excited about this bill. I think it largely fixes this problem that we've been confronting of out-of-control regulators and bureaucrats. I do think it'll pass the House, and we're going to push hard for it in the Senate. It's bipartisan in the Senate. It's got Rand Paul and Joe Manchin, the Democrat from West Virginia and the Republican from Kentucky, as the lead sponsors in the Senate side. And we think this needs to be a big issue for senators this next year. If they won't vote for this, why should we return people to the Senate who want to let the bureaucrats have all the power?
Is it fair to say, Phil, that this president, Barack Obama, would not sign such a bill and that it would have to override a veto?
Well, it's I think very few presidents are going to willingly give away all of the power that has been accumulated in the presidency. And so it's really incumbent, I think, on the American people to demand that. And I also think we got to make an issue of it in the presidential campaign among the Republicans. Make sure that if we do get a Republican president, it'll be someone who's willing to sign that bill and willing to sort of restore the separation of powers and the balance of powers between the branches.
Phil Kirpin is vice president for policy at Americans for Prosperity, and his new book, Democracy Denied, is available at the website, www.democracydenied.org. And you can learn about Phil and his work at Americans for Prosperity, and then get this book, Democracy Denied. Phil, I appreciate you sharing with our audience. It's an informative, it's scary stuff on a certain level, but you've got a lot of remedy in here as well. And so I appreciate you bringing this to the attention of our audience.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks for having me on the show.